Might as well open up in James chapter 5. James chapter 5. Let's see, I'm assigned chapter 5, verse 16 and 18. We'll read it here. Confess your trespasses to one another. Pray for one another that you may be healed. The effective, fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much. Elijah was a man with a nature like ours, and he prayed earnestly that it would not rain, and it did not rain on the land for 3 years and 6 months. And he prayed again, and the heaven gave rain, and the earth produced its fruit. Short and sweet here, I guess, these passages, and I will stay in my lane, like I was told to. I follow orders. I salute, execute. Aye, aye, sir. Three bags full. So, that's my context. Now I'm free, I guess, to do what I want. Okay, as I consider this passage, a couple of things here. Confess your trespasses to one another, pray for one another that you may be healed. You know, we know first century times, they actually had, physical healings, but when you think of the human, you know, as 1 Thessalonians 5 tells us, consisting of spirit, soul, and body. You know, anything we can have fault in. In other words, we might have physical illnesses. We could be spiritually not very healthy and sick. And our soul, same. You know, in our mind, our understanding, our cognitive ability, the part of us that's going to be judged. We're dysfunctional many times. Or I could also read that, just possibly in the context of Matthew 18, that you confess your trespasses to one another in the context of you've sinned against your brother. So in Matthew 18, he said, go to him and see about getting reconciled there. And you know, when people do that, that is amazing how that can strengthen a relationship between brothers or, you know, Christian sister too. You know, where they've had a falling out. And if they're willing to privately go out there and proverbially bury the axe or whatever the problem is and pray for one another, boy, that's what you want. And so I could see that in that context as well. Now, when I think of Galatians, 5:1, if one of you is overtaken in a fault, you who are spiritual, go and restore such a one. Because I'll tell you what, there is a lot of good in seeking wise counsel. You know, you don't have to reinvent the wheel. We're not alone in this thing. But be careful what you tell anybody that'll listen to you about your problems. Some people can't handle it. And the last thing you need is to see your stuff on Facebook or something. Because you were confessing, you thought that's what you were supposed to do. And so you started talking to people. They weren't all that spiritual. And they did not handle it right, and you got more problems now than you had before with it. So I'm just throwing out some things to think about. When I look at this verse, confess your trespasses to one another, pray for one another that you may be healed. Well, we all need that. We need to be wise. Okay. I don't necessarily look at this one being a physical healing, because why would you confess that? It might not be your fault. I mean, we've all had health issues. I don't expect a miraculous healing, and I don't think you do either. However, I want to get in here, down here a little bit further. He flows right on into what he says about Elijah. You know, believe it or not, sometimes we read through scriptures so fast, we don't pay much attention how connected they may be. But he talks about the effective, fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much. The Bible tells us, man, there is power in prayer. Some verses that come to mind, I think about Matthew chapter 17. You know, he comes down from the Mount Transfiguration and commotion down there at the bottom. You know, there was some guy showed up with a demon-possessed child. And while Jesus is up in the mountain with Peter, James, and John, he brings them to the other apostles and wants them to cast his demon out of their kid and couldn't do it. You know, and so Jesus found out what was going on, and he said, bring him to me. Kind of frustrated, you could kind of tell. And he rebukes this demon, and off it goes. So the others come to him privately, and he said, well, we couldn't do that. He said, look, if you're going to be serious about this, you can't be just going around and be so maybe... You know, they had power, but a little bit maybe flippant about, like this is just, hey, be gone, you know. He did put a little qualifier on there. This kind doesn't go out except by prayer and fasting. You better be serious if you're going to take on the devil, man. All right. But same as this context about seeing the effective, fervent prayer. Jesus obviously was one of those. But you know what? He's trying to get them to understand there is a power available to you. Because if you had faith, even as a grain of mustard seed, you could say that when he said this mountain, I believe he's like looking out here. You could see it. He means that one. To be uprooted and cast into the sea, and it would obey you. I can't even imagine what they thought when he was saying things like that. You know, is this just nutty? Is this just hyperbole? Is this just exaggeration? I don't believe that Jesus was given to ridiculous exaggerations to make his point. He actually meant it. But he wasn't talking about them granite ones. Mountains are obstacles. They're in your way. And sometimes they're so wide you can't get around them. They're so high you can't get over them. You can't go under them. You got to go what? Through the door. And Jesus said he's the door. So there's power in this prayer to move the mountains. And also, one of my favorites is out of Joshua chapter 10. Joshua's whooping on some of God's enemies and running out of daylight and calls for the sun to hold its place and the moon over Ajalon. I mean, the whole cosmic clock stops here. Pretty much figure the rotation of the earth had to stop for those things to be stuck where they were, while Joshua finished the job. And it says, never before had God hearkened unto the voice of a man. Wow! To stop the rotation of the planet? You know, I know, maybe you heard, I heard it too. Some people say, do you believe in that dumb ark story, man? I go, yeah, man. Jesus, I said, believed in that dumb ark story. I mean, they say, you believe in that dumb fish story, you know, Jonah and the whale? I go, yeah, I believe Jesus believed that dumb fish story. That's why I believe that dumb fish story. Tall tales or whatever was brought out this morning in the communion meditation. Tall tale, but true. And that's a tremendous foreshadow of Christ being 3 days in the heart of the earth, 3 days and nights of his burial and resurrection. Yeah, I believe that dumb fish. So yeah, I believe the earth stopped. Wouldn't take God nothing to just give it a spin, get that baby going again. That's power. But then he refers here, James refers to, James prayed fervently it wouldn't rain. It didn't rain on the land for 3 years and 6 months. And then he prayed that it would rain, because God told him, and it did rain. It poured. And that's when James is bringing out these points, and especially this one. Elijah was a man with a nature like ours, just like you and me, brethren. Now, what I really want to talk about here tonight, in this context, I mean, according to the lesson, Jake, I'm not going way off the rails here. But first off, I want to talk about this kind of power that is available for all of us right now in this 2025. I mean, in this century. There's all kinds of cool stuff in that Old Testament, and there's certainly a lot of miraculous moving and shaking and happening in the New Testament. And I get the feeling, and I've maybe felt that even myself, people just don't think God works like that anymore. That's all good and in the Bible, it's all true. But somehow we got God now back afar off and not overly convinced that God works in man today. And I'm here to prove to you tonight, oh yes, he does. Fasten your seat belt. That he does. We're not deists here. I don't believe we are. You know, deists believe God created, but that God, there's no miracles, there's no divine revelation, and God is not involved in the affairs of men. That's basically a deist. Believes a creator, but he don't do nothing. He just sits up there, I guess. But I'm going to prove to you tonight, oh, he's working all right. He's working. And I'm going to refer maybe every once in a while when I get going here. There's a catchy little tune. You know, I don't necessarily listen in like I have a playlist of something of what you call contemporary Christian music. But I've heard some. I like them. You know, some of them are kind of catchy. And I know Alan Marshall sings this Waymaker down there in the tube in London, you know, at the Stratford Station as people are going by. Because everybody seems to know that tune. Again, kind of catchy. I don't know if you've ever heard it. Singing about our God. He is a Waymaker, a miracle worker, a promise keeper, a light in the darkness. That's our God. That's who he is. And it's repeated a couple times. Waymaker, miracle worker, promise keeper, light in the darkness. That's our God. And then he goes off into this thing like, and he's always working. Even when we don't see him, he's always working. He never stops working. And they get rolling onto that little chorus that he's always working. There is a lot of truth in that song lyric. And if you haven't heard it, you might like it. Like I say, a pretty catchy tune. Now, I want to talk about a miracle and get a definition out of the way, because I want you to hear me right tonight. When you think miracle, Jesus did these miracles. And think of the miracle being setting aside natural law. Setting aside natural law. In other words, hear me, when I'm talking tonight, I am not talking about people born blind and somebody comes up, heal, and suddenly they see, literally. I'm not talking about paralyzed people in wheelchairs leaping out of their wheelchairs. I'm not talking about dead people literally being hauled into the morgue and somebody comes in, arise, or you know, Smitty, come forth and call him out of the grave. I ain't talking about that. No, that's setting aside natural law. Or somebody going down to the shore when some great Category 5 hurricane's coming to land and say, peace, be still. And all of a sudden there's a great calm. No, I ain't talking about that. But what I am talking about and what I'm going to show you is when statistically... Now, look, here's the deal. Some of you smarter than me, probably. When it comes to what are probabilities that something could happen coincidentally. Now, I've heard about this kind of thing where they can actually put some analysis into some probabilities if you put to them a particular scenario and you say, what is the chance of this happening? And they do some sort of calculation, you know, and they say, well, you know, the probability of that ever happening would be, let's say, 10% or, you know, whatever. It's like flipping a coin. You're going to be right half the time or something. Now, I don't remember what it is. I saw it one time. And these probabilities or these statistical possibilities, I've seen things where zeros go, you know, they say, no, really, when it hits the realm of impossible, it's not all that many zeros. It's zeros. But it ain't like 100 zeros. And it's at the point of it ain't happening. I'm going to talk about kind of in that realm where this cannot happen, and it does. I like to call them God sightings. Because when it really mattered and you really needed it, and boy, I mean, it happens. And I mean, real soon. And you go, there is no way that could happen. Well, now I mean without seeing no bright lights or visions or hearing strange music or smelling sweet smells. I mean nothing. Just a normal daily routine, and it all works out. So what I want to do is I want to share, because I want you to know that really, just like what God did with ordinary people like Joshua or with Elijah. Now, that was a miracle. Don't misunderstand what I'm saying. But what it said was they had a nature like ours. The power was obviously God's. It wasn't in them. But he worked through them. And we need to understand that. We have access to power right now and today if, and I like this passage too, and this is where I want to begin. I want to set the stage with 2 Chronicles 16. I'll just briefly say, if you remember, Asa was about ready to get overrun by a million Ethiopians. He prayed to God, and God defeated a million-man army of Ethiopians. Later, there was another problem with this same thing. They were in trouble again, but this time it was with, I don't know, Ben-Hadad or somebody here. I got to look at the context. But my point is, he hires somebody to help him, mercenaries. Paid him. And the prophet comes to him, what are you doing? After God delivered you from a million man army, you're going to go out and you're going to go in God's treasuries and take the money out and go hire these mercenaries to save you? You're doing a dumb thing here. Now, Asa gets mad. That throws the seer in prison. But here's what the prophet told him, and this is where I want to begin, getting our mindset to this way, what I want to bring out. That prophet told him, the seer said, verse 9, 2 Chronicles 16 and 9, for the eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth to show himself strong on behalf of those whose heart is loyal to him. And so in this, he said, you did foolishly. God looks all over this world to find somebody that he can show himself strong in. Someone with a like nature. Like me or you. We need to have that kind of faith that could accept that, because maybe that's exactly what he's going to do if you're willing. Here's my stories. Now, these are tall tales. Appreciate that communion meditation. They're tall tales. And I don't know what the probability is. It wouldn't be too good. But it happened. Because they're true. And I have a real benefit here tonight. Because some of the people that actually witnessed what I'm talking about are right under this tent. You're here. And you'll recognize that fact because I'm going to mention your name. So, see, I have a confidence that what I'm going to tell you, you're my cloud of witnesses. This really happened. And then you'll have to think, yeah, what is the chance of that happening? Okay, let's get going here. I went to Belarus by invitation in 1994. Jay and I both mentioned from up here before. That's where we met. We didn't know each other, you know, before the trip. We met each other here. So we were over there in the former Soviet Union. The collapse, we were doing these English classes. And the Soviet Union was a wreck. That Minsk was a dump, man. I mean, half the streetlights didn't work. The roads were in bad shape. The stores were empty. There wasn't food. We're trying to do English classes because the people of the former Soviet Union saw that knowing English was going to be a key to get out of that communist old broken down system, get into Western Europe, get into America, somewhere to have a life. It ain't going to be through Russian language. They needed English. They wanted English. They're willing to come to these classes by us going over there. We were using Bible-based materials. And the Russians didn't care, the Belarusians. It was English. That's all they cared about. Didn't care what it was. And what it resulted in was actually some people being converted to Christ. So it was a great tool. I think the non-instrumental brethren had put that together. It's called like Gets Talk or something. But one of the things you couldn't miss, the people come sitting at your table to go through that, man, they were poor. Clothes weren't so great. They hadn't eaten. Stores are empty. And they're fearful. They're fearful of their future. Okay. I thought, you know, I did that 1 year, 94, went back, did it again, 95, 96. And man, it was really bugging me because here I'm reading my scriptures and what do I see? Jesus, he was helping people. In the meantime, even James, it ain't my scripture, but James says, look, if you got a brother, sister, naked, destitute of basic food, and you just say, we'll pray for you, brother. We'll pray for you. And you don't give him nothing for his body, James says, what good is that? What good is that? A faith without works is dead. We had to do both. We need to do both. We do need to teach the people. We do need to care. We need to bring this good news, but you can't ignore their physical conditions. Matthew 9 and 35, he went through all the cities, all the villages, helping the people. He was sharing the gospel with people and healing all manner of sickness and disease. He told the apostles, you see this mess? You see this field? This harvest is ready. The fields are white, ready for the harvest. It's plenteous, but the laborers are few. Pray to the Lord of the harvest, send laborers into this harvest. And next thing you know, he sends them. And when I say, he's saying, look at this, it's all screwed up. Because they're wandering around like sheep without a shepherd. That is the world. It is broken. It looks like a plane crash. That means it's ready. It's ready for the harvest. These people need hope. You have to do both, though. You can't just show up and just do the Bible study. Don't get me wrong, you know I ain't knocking the scriptures. Well, what about their physical needs? Somehow, we have to incorporate, you know, what we do. So we started DCHA. We decided to start the nonprofit, or I did, and got that going. And So it was a big idea what I wanted to do. I thought we got to do more. So I went to a lawyer, got the thing organized, went to an accountant, got the 501c3. I'm all ready, man, because I read this book and there was a nonprofit agency that helps nonprofits get all their stuff to go. And it's in Michigan. It's an hour from me. So I go over there. I got warehouses full of food and medicine and clothes. And I said, man, how do I get this stuff? You partner with us. You could fill a whole seagoing container for $5,000 if you're a church or a nonprofit. And I was both. But I thought he meant $5,000 for the metal box. He said, no, the whole thing, what's in it? $100,000 value for $5,000. I thought, whoa. So I got this inventory from the guy, and I made me some pamphlets. I came here for family camp, this family camp. And people are asking me, because I'm trying to hand out pamphlets. They go, what are you trying to do? So I'm trying to get a container into Belarus. People say, where's Belarus? That's the first thing I ever said. Former Soviet Union. Oh, yeah. Well, at this camp was Tom and Karen Tuck, of course. You guys know. They're not here right now, but I know you know who they are. So Tom invites a coworker. He comes here. He's not a Christian. And his wife. And he said, what do you want to do? I said, I want to send a container into Belarus. Where's Belarus? Went through that. I had a pamphlet. I go, here. He takes it. Him and his wife. Thank you. Walk away. So I'm still handing out pamphlets. 6 weeks later, you guys know it's Pennsylvania Family Camp. About that same time frame. I'm in Pennsylvania Family Camp. Guess who shows up? Tom and Karen Tuck. Tom walks up to me and he said, hey, you remember my friend I invited from work? To come to Montana Camp? I go, yep. He said, he wanted me to give you this envelope. I opened the envelope, $5,000 from a stranger visiting this camp. And Tom is a witness of that. That happened. So now I've got $5,000 to fill that thing, but now I got to get it shipped. Well, that's another $5,000. I don't have that kind of money. I'm retired, right? Well, I think I was still working back then, but I still didn't have that kind of money. And I didn't have nothing in the fund. But the government had a program called Ocean Freight where you could fill out paperwork, like tons of it. If you got approved, they would ship your container anywhere in the world. So I filled out all the paperwork. I got approved. USAID said, where do you want it to go? I said, Belarus. They go, man, that's one of the toughest places to get in. Ain't you got another country? I said, no, it's the only country I got. Said, well, good luck with that, you know, but okay, I got approved. So now they're going to ship it. So I've got $10,000 already toward this idea, and none of it's my money. Okay, so now I've got the shipping, I've got the stuff, but I have nobody on the other end in Belarus to receive it. And trust me, trying to get a seagoing container shipped into a foreign country, and they all have all their own complicated, you know, port of entry, authorization, consignees, and I had nothing or any experience. Only person I know I could maybe ask was the lady I stayed with there before, where me and Jay stayed, was Galina Yashnikov, only because she spoke English. Yeah, that's a big help. Me and Matt Hartford were put together on the team, and we didn't know each other at that time till we got joined for the trip by the missionary Stuart Merrill. So when we were coming into Minsk, you know, I told him, hey, I gotta go to Galina's and all this, you know, and I gotta talk to her. And he wanted to go do an email back home to Jessica. So the day after we got there, we walked over, because we're staying in another house. We're with Olga, the eye doctor, who don't speak English. We walk over to Galina Yashnikov's. He goes into her computer, sits at her thing. He's doing an email. I'm talking to Galina at the kitchen table with drinking some tea, telling her, I got this idea. I want to help people here. I got to get a shipping container. I can get it, but I got to have somebody here. I'm trying to tell her what I need. And she's looking at me like, And while I'm talking to her, somebody's at the door. She goes, oh, just a second. So she goes. Next thing I know, she's got this guy walking in with her. And she's going, Steve, this is my neighbor, Nikolai. He lives upstairs. You know, this is a big apartment blocks. And she said, he lives upstairs. He goes, hello, Steve. How are you? He spoke great English. I said, I'm good. How are you? Good. So they get talking. I'm drinking tea. Matt's doing an email. He leaves. So she sits back down and she just tells me she's like, no idea what I can do about that kind of thing with this plan. So we go back to where we're staying, to Olga's, the eye doctor, who don't speak English. About 8, 9 o'clock at night, her phone rings and she hands me the phone. Like I get calls over there. I just got there. So I got this phone. I'm like, hello? And I hear this voice. Steve, this is Nikolai Balbutsky. I met you today at Galina's house. Do you remember me? And I'm like, yeah. He said, Galina says you want to do humanitarian work in Belarus. I said, well, I do. He said, well, that's what I do. I'm a charitable worker, volunteer. I bring shipping containers into the country for Operation Christmas Child. I deliver them to orphanages and disabled homes and poor people all over the whole country. Are you interested in seeing these places? I'm like, yeah. He put me and Matt in his dumpy old car. He tore the exhaust off, taking some scientists out in the Chernobyl zone. So we're roaring down the road, and the fumes in the back. I'm being gassed. Going to orphanages and old broken down schools. And he's sitting right there. What I just told you, Nikolai came to the door the next day. Now, so far, follow me now. Already, what's the probability? Because you want to know what my effectual fervent prayer? I'll let you decide how righteous I am. Was, I said, Lord, I'm going to need some help. I would have been embarrassed to say, Lord, I need a guy. A guy that speaks fluent English, who knows every orphanage, all the poor, all the disabled children in the whole entire country, and knows how to get shipping containers through the most difficult customs in the whole world. In Jesus' name, amen. I would have been ashamed to pray a prayer like that because I would have never believed that he would answer that kind of a prayer. All I said was, Lord, I'm going to need some help. And that is exactly what I got the next day. He was right there when it happened, when that guy knocked on the door and came in. Matt was right there. We still have that relationship with Nikolai. That was 98. This is 25. That was 27 years ago. We have baptized both him and his wife into Christ. And he's still doing the same work. Nikolai. And Nikolai actually was here once. You know, I want to do something just real quick. If you guys don't mind. All you guys that have been to Belarus that know Nikolai, who I'm talking about, if you don't mind, just raise your hand for a second, because there's too many of you for me to be able to count them all. Yeah, I see them, okay, scattered all over the place. Yeah, that's right. Now, what I'm saying, remember how I started this conversation? Just a regular person that had an idea that didn't know how to do the idea. I'm going to remind you of John chapter 6. Jesus is just getting done preaching. There's all these people here, thousands of them. So Jesus looks at the apostles and said, "Are we going to get enough bread to feed these people?" You know, and Philip was like, "Boo, yeah, like what are we going to do?" You know, and Andrew, "Well, we got this kid over here. He's got 5 loaves and 2 fish." And the parentheses, it says, Jesus already knew what he was going to do. He wanted to see what they said about it. And they had that deer in the headlights look. Yeah, what are we going to do about this? 200 penny worth wouldn't be enough for everybody to get a little bit. He said, have the people sit down. Bring me them fishes and the 5 loaves. He blessed it, gave it back. He said, make the distribution. And there was probably, 15,000 because he didn't count the women and the kids. If you did that right now, there's more women, I think, under this tent than there is men. I'm just saying. And that's what they did. And they had the scraps or the fragments left over. Leftovers. Baskets of them. That's our God. He is the way maker, the miracle worker, the promise keeper, the light in the darkness. That's our God. Same yesterday, today, and forever. What are the probabilities of even what I just told you so far? Strangers at family camps, or not even Christians, giving me $5,000 in cash. Government pays the other $5,000. I need a consignee. He comes to the door the very next day. And he knows the whole country. We're still in contact with him. He's a Christian now. I see it keeps going. We met Dr. Rogoff at one of those English classes. He was a pathologist in the country. In fact, his job was to teach all the Belarusian pathologists in his whole country, like 300 of them. When the Soviet Union collapsed, he came up to me at the English class. He's at the English class. He said, I hear you want to do humanitarian work here. He said, can you give me some books? I said, what kind of books you need? He told me, I'm a doctor. I have a responsibility to train all these doctors. But when the Soviet Union collapsed, they took all the books. Not textbooks, the books you build curriculum with. Thick ones like that. And all the microscopes. I have nothing. He said, our skill level is in the 1950s. He told me that, 98. I said, you got a list of them books? Yeah, he gave me a list, a printed list. I went back from Belarus. I went to Barnes & Noble. I walked in. I said, hey, can you guys get me these books? We'll try. They got me all those books. There's, like I say, 16 of them. I got tons of books now, big, heavy things, because they're big books. I got him them books. Somebody gave me $10,000 to buy that dude a microscope. A big one, electric one, with a monitor so the whole classroom could see the tumors and the cancers and all the stuff on there. And he went to work. He went to work. And every year, the annual pathology conference for all of Europe, Western Europe, every year he said, could you help me maybe to go to that? He needed a few $100 for a plane ticket and a registration fee. And it would either be in Paris or in Athens or in Rome or some Western Europe place. He'd go there for the whole thing and he'd bring all that knowledge back. Fast forward a few years. You know what he told me one day? He said, thanks to God. And he's also, we baptized him, baptized Yuri Rogoff, the head of all that training for pathology for the whole country. And he was with the Department of Health, whatever. We baptized him in a hotel bathtub. He's a brother. And he's on my Zooms to this day in 2025. But Yuri said, thanks to God and you, hundreds of lives have now been saved. And our skill level is equal to the United States and Western Europe. One man did that for that whole country and said hundreds of lives. Now, granted, I know the spiritual side is the whole goal, but hey, you can't do Bible studies if they're dead. proper diagnosis of disease and tumors is vital too. And we help one guy. And this is for free. These guys, there's hundreds of those doctors, or even hit 1,000 at those European conferences. Well, them doctors like to have a little fun, maybe on their break time. They slap the tumor up on the big screen down there and ask a whole auditorium with pathologists from all over, from the United States, from all over Western Europe, literally all over the world, and ask if anybody, any of you guys identify those tumors. There was a tie for first place. The only two that could do it. A tie. An Israeli pathologist and Dr. Yuri Rogoff from Belarus diagnosed that properly, what it was. One man. What God can do, the way maker, the miracle worker. What is the probability of some of all this, all the moving parts that had to come to that outcome, that end. Vietnam. I was in upstate New York where Benoit, where you at, Benoit? He's back there somewhere. He ratted me out the other day. That's where we met, upstate New York at the same family camp I'm going to tell you about. There was a Church Christ guy. You know, there's the non-instrumental brethren up there. You know, and he got there by accident. He didn't know most of the people were the other persuasion. But he was there, so he preached. His name was Bill McDonough. And he was doing the lessons about what they're doing to help people. They've got quite a humanitarian outreach program, the non-instrumental guys. Partners in Progress, I think is what it's called. So he's preaching, and he's talking about Vietnam, all the work they were doing in Vietnam. Of course, I perked right up because I've been going there, you know, since 2000. You know, that's 25 years now. But see, we were making some real progress, but I didn't know where the Christians were. Now, when the U.S. military was there for 10 years during the war, they brought a lot of scatterings or smatterings of various, you know, Christianity, you know, of all different flavors, and none of it really stuck together much or whatever, and I wasn't really looking for that. This guy speaks, and he was doing Bible studies with the underground church in Vietnam with the Church Christ guys, like a group of 35. They had to meet secretly. And what they were sharing with him, which he shared with all of us at the upstate New York camp, they'd been imprisoned, some of them beaten, tortured for their faith, the Vietnamese, by the communists. And they were telling him that. And he said, what else can we do? Anything we can do to help you? And you know what their response was? Yes. Send us more Bible teachers. So Bill said to them, you've been through all of that and you want more Bible teachers? They said, you send us the teachers and we will hold the meetings. And he's sat there. The minute he got done, I made a beeline right to the guy. I said, hey, I go there on a regular basis. We're doing humanitarian stuff, whatever. I said, you give me that guy's contact information. We go back there. I'll do Bible studies with them people. And he goes, yeah, you know. But he didn't give it to me right that second. I had his email. He gave me his email. So I didn't get no contact information from him at that meeting. But then, you know, I emailed him. I said, hey, man, you know, I'm getting ready to go here pretty soon. I need that guy's contact information. No, silence. He doesn't respond. I email him again. No response. Well, I knew that Karen and Tom Tuck were going to see that guy. And Sherry Dingman, she's from here too. Y'all might know Sherry Dingman. She's all wet east now. I got a hold of Sherry. Said, hey, get a hold of that guy and tell him I need that information now. Sherry calls me back. She goes, Steve, he ain't giving you that information. I go, what? He said, because you and that guy that goes with you, he's a national, and you both work for the government, and the police will be watching you like a hawk, and you lead the cops right to the church. I thought, baloney. That's not the reason. That wasn't the reason at all. They didn't give me no contact information. So you know what I had to do? I gave it to God. And I did. I said, Lord, if you want me to study with those people, Lord, you're going to have to make it happen. Because Saigon, if you Google it, 10 million. Where would you go look for 10, go to a city with 10 million people in it looking for 35 people that are hiding who don't want to be found? And you got no contact information? How are you going to do it? You know, guess you better get a hold of the Waymaker. Because I had no way, Hosea. I had no idea. I just gave it to God. I said, Lord, you're going to have to make it happen because I don't even know what to do. So I put it on my mind. And me and Jay went to the Philippines. And we were traveling around village to village, you know, one village, you know, after another for days. And we were on a kind of a break, you know, with the Filipinos, man, and we're eating flies and rice. And some of the Filipinos said, Brother Steve, where else do you go? Oh, we do stuff in Belarus or Kosovo or Vietnam. And he said, you go to Vietnam? I said, yeah. They said, Sister Mackie's in Vietnam. You know, she's working there. It's a Filipino. I said, she Christian? Yeah. Do you have contact information for her? Yeah. Would you give it to me? Yeah. They give me an email. So I email this lady, Mackie. I said, you with the church in Vietnam and boo, 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 and... yeah, I don't really understand Vietnamese, what they're saying, but I go there. The preacher's name is Min, and she sends me his name and his phone number. I go see my buddy Bach. You know, Bach was rescued by the U.S. as Saigon fell to the communists in 75. Because he was working for the U.S. Department of Defense, and they got him out of there. The communists would have killed him. Him and his wife got him out of there. So Bach and I were going over there. I said, well, here, call this guy first and find out more about him. So Bach calls him, gets him on the phone, you know. And I'm just sitting there, and he says he's a Church Christ guy. I said, really? Okay, well, that's good. You know, but I have no idea who he is really, as far as, is he any of them people I wanted to go actually see? I don't know. And Bach says he wants you to come and meet with them when we get there. Well, you know, and I'm like, okay. He said he'll meet us at the hotel. We arrived in Saigon. This guy shows up with his wife. It's a Saturday. And we got talking with him. He said, I'll have to come here tomorrow and take you to the place. So, okay. I'm ready, you know, for that Sunday. And Bach is starting to tell me, this is making me real nervous because he knows how the communists are. And going around to secret meetings and all that stuff, he barely got out of there with his life before. I said, Bach, this is what it's all about, man, for me. So Min shows up the next day, Sunday, and he said, we're not going out the front door of the hotel. It was a nice hotel, and they had doormen, you know, and every one of them guys is a spy. You know, they report everything they see. So we have to go out basically the back door. There's a great big hotel. We walk out on a side door, out onto the sidewalk. Traffic busy as heck. 10 o'clock in the morning, and Min flags a cab. We get in the cab, and driver's asking him for the address. And Bach, or the driver won't, or Min won't give him the address. He just tells him, go. And then turn. The guy keeps asking for the address. He said, no, turn here, turn here. Well, it's busy traffic, you know. And then he tells the guy to stop. And then tells us to get out. You know, Mike Cobra, I think, was with me on that one, too. So we had to get out of the car. We're on the sidewalk, and men don't move until that car is gone in the traffic, that taxi. He said, look, come. So now we're walking down the street. Then we turn down another street. Then we go into an alley. And it's a alley, man. There's trash, man. It's 10 o'clock in the morning, and we're sweating like crazy. It's so hot. Laundry hanging, you know, dogs, and it's a, you know, Baca's like, I'm going to wait back here at the head of the alley and keep watch. I don't know what he's going to watch for. So me and Mike go with men. All of a sudden, he goes in a side door in this alley. We go in there, and man, you couldn't hardly see. It was dark, kind of. But there was people in there. They were sitting on the floor, sitting on old plastic chairs. So we get in there, and men, they had a pulpit of boxes stacked up. He wanted me to give a little lesson. So I did the lesson. And then they had communion, most humble communion I ever had, man. I mean, they had mismatched cups, paper cups, big coffee cups, dollhouse cups, and whatever that bread was. I ain't sure. It was hot in there. Moldy walls. Skeeters, flies. Then it was fellowship time. They broke out the fruits. Broke out some bananas, some pineapples. Min is sitting right in front of me. I said, hey, Brother Min, I got a question for you. You ever heard of a guy named Bill McDonough? Because I'm looking, there's about 30 people in there. And he said, yes. He used to come here and Bible study with us. Will you Bible study with us? Man, I had chills. The very thing that guy said, what they said, the last thing, please send us Bible teachers. And he asked me, will you Bible study with us? I said, yes. The next day in some dumpy hotel, we're all jammed in this thing, man. All these people, they're sitting on their beds and sitting on the floor, and they're all over the place. And I'm standing up doing the teaching. They're sitting down. They're very studious. They're quiet. They're gentle people. They were writing in there. They had Bibles. And I'm doing a lesson. And all of a sudden, I was overwhelmed with emotion. Because I realized I am in the will of God in this place. And it was the most humbling thing I ever felt. I had tears. I'm trying to, because they weren't looking at me and I was trying to power through. But when I looked at all of them, the very people that had suffered so much that wanted Bible teachers. Now, there's witnesses in here. I know I saw Gary DiPaolo earlier. He's been there in those very same things. And Brother Sue right here has been in there. He knows men. And now when we go, and I'm leaving on the 28th of November, we've been doing this for over 15 years with those guys, even though I've been going to the country for 20-some. Man, we're going to Underground Church in Hanoi, down one of their alleys. Canto, way in the south, Vung Tau. They're all over the place. And we preach the very thing that was being preached, you know, in this, that it, right here. The whole gospel, the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God, and it's shining. And if you, now what I'm saying, you tell me, what are the chances, if you ask somebody that does that statistical analysis, what are the chances that you would find 35 people hiding in a city of 10 million? God dropped us like a smart bomb, like he did Philip into that chariot with that Ethiopian in it over a great distance, right in their lap. We're right in there with them, the very same people. We did not have to look all over the place to find them. God brought us right to them and right in their midst. What is the possibility? You know what I'm saying? I didn't see no visions. I didn't smell no sweet smells. I didn't get anything like that. But I'm telling you, that story is true. Brother Sue's been there. Davy and Sue aren't here, but you guys know them. Gary, are you in here, Gary, somewhere? There's Gary. He's been there two or three times. Brother Sue, same thing. Those are real people. That story is true. Brother Jay was with me in the Philippines. When the Filipinos was the one that gave me the connection, even though I didn't know that's who it was, and didn't know until I popped that question to Min. And he said, yes, he used to come here. Ban Ruth sang in Myanmar. He was my interpreter for 9 hours. I was sicker than a dog the first got there. I was supposed to split those teaching with Burmese people in the morning, preachers, and I was supposed to do the afternoon. They took me to lunch right after I got there on Lord's Day, and I said, uh-oh, this place is a dump. I told those plates were wet that were on the table. I poured that water off there, and I said to Doc and Pete, I can't eat off this plate. I got my Kleenexes out. I'm drying this thing off. And I said, hey, guys, sorry, I got to do this. I can't eat. Oh, go ahead, brother. Now, he was going to order for everybody, and we're all going to dive in. I said, no, I just want some fried rice on my dry plate. He tells the waiter that. So next thing I know, he shows up with fried rice on a wet plate, takes my dry plate, pops the wet one down, and walks away. I thought, oh, great. Because I'm thinking, where'd he wash this thing off at? Water, you guys know if you've traveled, that's a big deal. I'm sure they had some sanitary water, or what do you call the bottled water that they're doing dishes with. Of course they were. Probably out of the river by in the back. So I thought, I'll just eat off the top. I'll be safe if I just skim off the top and don't go down to where the plate was at. Well, 4 o'clock in the morning, I realized that didn't work. I'm sicker than a dog. I can't go down there. I'm doing my lessons. So they had to cover it all day. And man, I was trying to survive. Next morning, you know, Doc and P, he was worried about me. I said, I'll come down for just a morning. And my stomach looked like a bag of doorknobs. I felt terrible. And I got through 3 hours, but they had gotten a new interpreter because now the old one that was there yesterday wasn't there. And this guy hung in there with me, Van Rusang. And so Doc and Pete said, now tomorrow you get the whole day. You'll get all the morning sessions and all the afternoon to get 9 hours in. I'm like, okay. I went down there. I stood there for 6 hours, and he translated everything, and it blew his interpreting mind. Young guy. He was a dean of students from Myanmar Bible Institute. Young guy, 30 years old. At that time, not married. And we were done, and the guys were coming up to say, thank you for coming, brother. And he's pulling on my arm. Brother Steve, I need more. I need to know more of what you're saying. And he's pulling on me here. They're trying to say goodbye to me over here. He said, I need more. I said, if I got you a visa or something to the U.S., could you come? I didn't want to come back there and do it. But the chances are there's no way he could get a visa at 30 years old coming from a third world country like that. No way, Hosea. I sent him a letter of invitation. He went to the U.S. Embassy. They gave him a 6-month visa. He came to my house. He didn't miss a thing. He saw the whole thing, whole picture, grabbed all Jay's books. He speaks great English. And he took all his books. And I'm upstairs the next morning getting my coffee and all that, and I'm looking at my phone. He's downstairs on Facebook sending messages back to them people back there, how you can overcome sin. I had to go downstairs and say, brother, be cool. Don't put all that back there to them people on Facebook. Why not, brother? I said, because you got a bunch of old dinosaurs over there like we do. Don't want to hear nothing. They'll freak out. You start doing it. You're going to lose your job at Myanmar Bible Institute. They won't let you near them kids talking like that. Really? I said, think about it. Who killed Jesus? Most religious guys in the whole world. The establishment. Okay, brother. Guess what he's doing right now? Because I told him, you select some students that you got that are really tracking, man. You pull them aside. You show them the way more perfectly. That's what he's doing. He said, brother, I incorporate this in all my teaching. And now I got all my students, and they're all helping translate all Jay's books into Burmese, into their language. And I study with him every other Friday, and I have for the last 5 years. And that word is getting spread out. God is the way maker, the miracle worker. The impossible things belong to God. It's impossible how all that came to pass. The promise keeper. All they got to do is ask, seek, and knock, and they'll have it. Seek the Lord while he may be found. That's the promise. That's the promise. That's God's promise. And it's happening. And the light, the way maker, miracle worker, the promise keeper, the light in darkness. The light in the darkness is still shining. Just like in the first century, it's still working today. The effectual fervent prayer of a righteous man. Elijah impacted quite as a national thing with that drought. God worked through one man, Joshua. He still works through the individual. His eyes still go to and fro through the whole earth to find someone that he can work through to be strong. I got to throw this in because some of you know Dave Fagan. When I first got involved with Myanmar, Dave Fagan got a hold of me and said, we got a guy here. We're bringing him in from Burma. And he has a need for a medical clinic. They'd bring him up here. Dave was going through cancer at the time. It was right after he'd been here. And he's going through cancer treatments. So they brought him up to my house, Doc and P, and his wife, Ruth. They told me the need. We've got people dying all the time, mostly Church Christ people. They're dying. The clinic is closed. The government don't have no money. And we need to get that reopened. I said, well, how much you need for an operation like that? Well, we need about $20,000 a year. Well, I didn't have $20,000 for that, you know. I said, I'll tell you what, I believe in what you're trying to do. It's a good thing. And I believe if anything is not illegal, immoral, ungodly, or dangerous, and it's a good and right thing to do, then we're going to get behind it. Well, how are we going to do it? I have no idea. I don't have any idea how to do it, but it needs to be done. We'll do it anyway. Okay. So I had to take him back down to Dave's in Indiana. And there was an elder from another congregation in Michigan doing work in Myanmar, and he was with me. He was on the go. So I put Doc and P and Ruth in the car, headed down there. Dave was actually at a chemo treatment, so we didn't take him to his house. They said, take him to Dave's brother's, another farm down there. So we pulled in the driveway and delivered Doc and P and Ruth to Dave's brother. So we're sitting in the farmhouse, you know, just kind of saying, well, you know, it's a great visit. It's a good program, what he needs, and we'll do what we can. Just having a little chat, you know. And all of a sudden, a car comes flying in the driveway, the gravel driveway, a cloud of smoke, you know, dust flying in the air. And in walks Dave's son, Matt, a preacher, too, young guy. And he's all out of breath. We got the money. One congregation gave him $20,000, just like that. Doc and Pete's sitting there, and I'm going, well, that didn't take long. To fund that clinic for the year. We're still doing it. That was 2007, right after, and Dave died right after that. And this is 2025. That medicine is still going into that country. We've been able to do it every year like a horn of plenty. I don't know how God does it, but it's a miracle worker. The impossible things belong to God. Bring it to Him if you have the faith for it, and things happen. And Doc Compete, unsolicited from me, mentioned to me one day, he said, you know, Brother Steve, this clinic, since we've been able to do this, he said the same thing Dr. Yuri Rogoff said, hundreds of lives have been saved because of medicine. A basic need, that all humans need that, food, water, medicine. God is that way maker, and He's working. Even when you don't see Him, He's working. He never stops working. Never stop, never stop. And He hasn't stopped for thousands of years. It's the same God. So don't ever think that you can't make a difference. Even when you don't know how the heck we're going to do it. I don't know how to do it. I didn't know how to do any of it. I'm just here to tell you the stories that I just said. Gary's been to Myanmar many times. He knows these guys. He's done the same big Bible studies with us, with them Burmese people. But by the hundreds, we've had those studies. I know Jeff is doing the same thing. He incorporates the medical with his works in Ghana and Benoy. You know, we've got to do not just, you know, like you said, the Lord told them, you know, these guys tithe many times, people, brethren of the Pharisees or whatever they are, of the minutes and coming, but they neglect the weightier matters of judgment, mercy, and faith. These need to be done, not leave the other undone. Do them both. There's a place for the humanitarian. And you don't have to go overseas and do shipping containers and do all that. I'm talking about, how about a cup of cold water in the name of a disciple and making a difference for somebody's eternity? We all can do that. So, I just want to encourage you to let you know, and if you don't know that song, Waymaker, it's catchy. You ought to listen to it. Google it. Put it on your, what do you call the thing, Spotify. It's a good song. And there's a lot of truth in it. Because God does make it happen. And He is working. And He's never stopped. And He'll use you and I to the praise of His glory. And Jesus, we pray. Amen.